From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
From National Public Radio, I'm Lisa Simeone with NPR World of Opera.
Recently, yet another controversy flared at the intersection of NPR and politics. The D.C.-based newsletter Roll Call revealed that Lisa Simeone, host of World of Opera, had been serving as a spokesperson for an economic justice rally allied with the Occupy Wall Street protests. This was quickly condemned by conservative blogs. Simeone was promptly fired by the documentary program Soundprint for violating ethics guidelines governing public radio journalists and explicitly forbidding public advocacy. The producers of World of Opera, an arts program, took no such action. But then NPR announced that it would no longer distribute World of Opera, at which point the anger flew in, this time from the left. Joyce Slocum is NPR's interim president and CEO. Her tenure ends December 1st, when she took the job back in March. She was in the crosshairs of conservative politicians after the firing of commentator Juan Williams and the supposedly smoking gun video manufactured by James O'Keefe. Hey, Joyce, welcome back to the show. In with a bang, out with an opera, huh?
Thanks, Bob.
Tell me, please, who made the call on suspending distribution of World of Opera?
It was really a mutual decision between us and WDAV. We had a problem with having the NPR brand attached to a program being hosted by someone who was very politically active. And, you know, through a series of very amicable and reasonable conversations, worked out a compromise that served everyone's interest. Lisa kept her job. World of Opera continues to be distributed to all the stations to which it was previously distributed. And NPR's name's no longer associated with it.
But it is associated with censoring a voice. That is the accusation that is all over the blogosphere and elsewhere with respect to ending the distribution deal.
You know, when people take certain roles in life, they make choices about what they can and can't do. I adhere to the same code of ethics that our journalists do. Lisa was serving as host, a very public figure representing NPR, so long as NPR's name was associated with the show. You know, we had ceased production of the show back in January 2010, and production went over to WDAV. And nobody seemed to have a problem with that. So I have to tell you, I'm a little puzzled about why anyone objects to WDAV taking on distribution when no one objected to them taking on production 2 years ago.
But are you really puzzled?
I am puzzled.
Because it looks like NPR is somehow caving to purely political interests. That's how it appears to the people who are complaining. And I must say, also to me. So you're not confused about that. Are you?
I said I'm puzzled as to why anyone would object to this resolution when it serves the interests of all concerned. It really will be completely seamless to the listener. The only thing that will happen is it will no longer be NPR World of Opera. It will be World of Opera. That doesn't seem very objectionable to me.
Let's change the subject slightly to another conflict of interest event that occurred hard by the Simeone incident. And that is Michelle Norris, co-host of All Things Considered, who is stepping down temporarily from her hosting duties while her husband is an employee of the Obama reelection campaign. Now, that is explicitly covered by the ethics code, no?
Yes. The ethics code would not have required Michelle to step down as host, but it, of course, does require her to recuse herself from any coverage of the election. And having a host of a program like All Things Considered who can't cover election matters in a presidential election cycle, stepping away from the host role was just a natural conclusion that we all came to together.
And it just so happened that these two personnel matters would be clustered together in the context of your successor, Gary Nell, coming in, stating publicly that he wishes to depoliticize NPR. Now, it isn't entirely clear what he means by that, and I certainly won't ask you to explain it for him. But I wonder if these two decisions represent some sort of running start to somehow depoliticize NPR.
The confluence of these two is sort of interesting because people of one sort of perspective criticizing the decision regarding Lisa Simeone. You had people of another perspective criticizing the decision regarding Michelle Norris. And I think it really is a demonstration of the fact that we do the right thing. We think about it carefully. We try to work out reasonable compromise positions. And I think that's really what Gary is saying when he says he wants to depoliticize NPR. I actually talked with him about what he meant about that. And he didn't mean, of course, taking political coverage out. He meant doing the right thing, not thinking about it from a political standpoint, one side or the other.
The politicization of NPR has, it seems to me, been imposed on it by third parties. You know, others have decided to accuse NPR of somehow being a platform for progressive thought or Radio Moscow or whatever it is that conservative critics seem to be irritated about. So then how would it be within the network's own power to depoliticize?
You know, it only becomes a fight if we engage. We're going to continue to do the right thing and not, you know, be influenced by political views one way or the other.
But the Simeone situation looks for all the world to be NPR engaging in that debate and trying to assuage outside critics who see her participation with the Occupy Wall Street crowd as the smoking gun for NPR's liberal bias. Have you not engaged by discontinuing distribution of an opera show?
Not at all. We've been true to what this organization stands for by removing NPR's association with someone who wants to be a political activist.
Well, there's my answer. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Joyce Slocum is interim president and CEO of NPR. She will be replaced on December 1st by incoming president Gary Nell. By December 31st, the drawdown of all 40,000 U.S. troops now in Iraq will be complete, despite the Obama administration's efforts to prolong their stay to help stabilize the country. It has, in fact, been a long, hard slog.
On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selective targets of military importance.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
It's simply too soon to measure the success of the surge.
It's not a matter of how long we're in Iraq. It's whether we succeed in Iraq or not.
Today, I can report that, as promised, the rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year.
The media, which fell down on the job in the run-up to the war, will arrive en masse to document the withdrawal. Liz Sly is now Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post, but she reported on Iraq for the better part of 8 years and will return to cover America's departure. She mused about the tug of war over the depiction of the war, especially at its lowest point.
When the whole country was just falling apart, and I would say especially in 2006, you know, you were having like 60, 80, 90 deaths a day in Baghdad, and they were still trying to put a positive spin on it. The huge gap between what the military was saying about how well things were going and how transparently, awfully they were going on the ground. I think it was at that point that people really, really began to lose interest, and it became very complicated and nobody really wanted to know. There was a real yearning to believe that this was going to work out. Perhaps that had something to do with the psychology of needing a success story after 9/11 or something like that. But I think it took a long time before people actually registered how long this was going.
What can we expect of the coverage of the withdrawal?
I think our role will really be to inform Americans who've switched off just what has come out of this war and what kind of Iraq America is leaving behind.
What kind of Iraq is America leaving behind?
They're not leaving behind a democracy. That has become clear. There are human rights abuses. There are issues of freedom of speech. People are being detained for criticizing the government. Al-Qaeda is still there. It's probably the country with one of the strongest Al-Qaeda presences that there is. By not ensuring a long-term presence there, they're basically leaving behind a country in which they don't really have all that much influence at all. At the end of the day, you have to wonder what it was all for.
Has nothing been gained? I mean, a tyrant is gone. The government-sponsored murder is down to a bare minimum, no?
To from the Iraqis' point of view is slightly different. Yes, their tyrant is gone. I suspect that a majority of the Shias of Iraq probably feel they're better off today than they were under Saddam. The Kurds are absolutely delighted that America came, have never hidden that. So on balance, you can't say that there's been nothing in it for at least some Iraqis.
As the war proceeded and became such a quagmire, it seemed that the public just simply lost interest. Now that the American withdrawal is happening with less of a bang than a whimper, do you think anybody even cares?
People should care. People should care because America spent about $750 billion, I think that's on the two wars, and 4,500 lives were lost. You cannot underestimate the huge amount of American stature and prestige that was on the line, what it achieved and what it leaves behind.
As you look at that Excel spreadsheet of American investment in blood and treasure and prestige, if we can assume that the return on investment at the end of the Bush administration was tragically low, has the Obama administration and its approach to the war helped us recover any of that investment low these past 2.5 years?
I don't really see the Obama administration as really having influenced all that much that's happened over the past couple of years. I would say the U.S. military did, in the end, rescue itself from some of the disasters committed in the early years. But I don't think America's reputation will ever stop paying for the mistakes of those early years. And that's why we're seeing the withdrawal happen when America really didn't want it to happen.
Liz, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Liz Sly is Baghdad Bureau Chief for The Washington Post.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, offering email marketing and social media resources for marketing small businesses. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art, seeking to improve Americans' understanding of Muslim arts and cultures, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. They call it the Super Committee, the United States Congress Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction. This bipartisan group of 6 senators and 6 congressmen is charged with forging a deficit compromise before Thanksgiving or else. The or else would be a $1.2 trillion automatic spending cut, largely from the defense budget. The committee negotiates in secret.
Well, Aaron, I'm not going to go into all the details that happened within the super committee, but let me just say we've had lots of back and forth.
Say that. Now, listen, you know, I'm not going to divulge everything that's happening in these discussions, but there has been progress.
I think these discussions are best left to the meetings and not to try to characterize them in the press.
As transparency freaks, our reflex is to condemn a process so opaque. Yet, with the government frozen in the grip of unbreakable deadlock, we wondered, is this one of those moments when less sunlight is better? Donnie Shaw is the lead writer for Open Congress, a project of the Participatory Politics Foundation and the Sunlight Foundation, two leading transparency groups. Matthew Iglesias is a writer for Think Progress and a fellow at the left-leaning Center for American Progress Action Fund. Donnie, Matthew, welcome to On the Media.
It's good to be here.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Donnie, let's start with you. You have called the Super Committee, quote, an anti-democratic institution by design. How?
They pretty much wiped out the vast majority of Americans from the normal representative democratic process. Most people don't have a representative serving on the committee. And that really limits how effectively the public can give input into the committee and how well they can hold them accountable.
Matt?
I don't think there's anything undemocratic about it exactly. Any output that they do would still need to pass Congress and be signed by the president to come into law. I don't think that appointing special committees to do the detail work on issues is a particular violation of any of our principles.
Well, you know, I think there's someone who agrees with you. Let me play you a little clip of tape.
Consider anything unless...
Why does this have to happen in secret?
Because it's the only way it's going to happen. Because you can't solve Social Security and ask people to run for election at the same time. So why not give politicians some cloud cover and let them be lawmakers for a while? 15 people in a room with the door closed, and they walk out of that room, and with one voice, they make a recommendation to Congress and the American people.
Matt?
You know, the views that that Toby Ziegler was espousing there in the West Wing does seem correct to me. It's not that you want major policy changes to be made in secret, but you need people to be able to have secret discussions with one another about what their real negotiating positions are.
If a couple members want to hold a meeting where they can discuss things over lunch or something, that's great. I just think that the standard operating procedure should be openness.
You know, well, that sounds great, but you and I both know that if you put a U.S. congressman in front of a microphone and ask what the weather is, you know, you're going to get spin. They're just constantly processing political consequences of every single word they utter. Shouldn't we give them some permission to operate where they can actually say what's on their mind?
Transparency isn't just about cameras. It's about access to open government data so that we have time to review legislation, so that we have version control of legislation so we can see who put what provision in and where and why. And right now, we're sorely lacking in those basic kinds of disclosures.
Certainly, I mean, if they do reach an agreement, it would be fascinating to know, you know, who did what was whose idea. That kind of transparency about outcomes is really great. But I just think that if we want to have any optimism at all about the idea that this committee is going to solve the problem they've been tasked with solving, we have to let them hold their meetings, say what's really on their minds, and have an honest negotiation.
That hasn't been the case so far. So far, more than half of the meetings that the super committee has held have been secret from the public. On the other hand, they're not secret from corporations and special interests who can afford these expensive access lobbyists who, according to reports, are getting readouts from the committee meetings and are able to arrange then one-on-ones to protect their interests from the super committee.
Can you document how much access insiders have to the still more inside members of the committee?
At this point, it's basically anecdotal. There have been some reports that already 200 groups have reported that they've been lobbying the super committee. One of the things we would support is quicker disclosure of both lobbying and campaign donations while the super committee is in effect.
Aren't there some legislative proposals on the floor to accomplish just that?
Yeah, there are, but I believe the bill in the House has 4 co-sponsors and, you know, doesn't have any leadership support. It doesn't look likely to advance.
Matt Iglesias, are you not concerned about the ability for others to influence the conversation or at least have access to it while the rest of the citizenry is just completely shut out?
It's difficult in American politics to draw a super sharp contrast between, you know, the insiders and the rest of the citizenry. Americans are represented through associations and groups that they belong to and that work in D.C. I think it's a huge problem that business interests have disproportionate power over Congress relative to environmental groups or labor unions or something like that. But that's a problem that, you know, relates to the social structure of the United States, to our campaign finance laws. Why would holding the meetings in public with cameras on actually resolve that?
The whole notion of this super committee hinged on the assumption that the status quo wasn't working. Is there any evidence that you guys can see so far that the super committee is behaving any differently than the Democratic and Republican parties at large?
No. I mean, there's a very serious disagreement about the desirability of increasing taxes, and I don't believe that kicking this to one committee or another is going to change that fact.
Yeah, I agree. I think that all indications show that this is just going to end in a stalemate.
Donnie Shaw is lead writer for Open Congress, a project of the Participatory Politics Foundation and the Sunlight Foundation. Matthew Iglesias is a writer for Think Progress and a fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund.
Another secrecy story. In the late 70s, the CIA was trying to duck a Freedom of Information Act request about its ties to the Glomar Explorer, a submarine retrieval ship owned by eccentric millionaire Howard Hughes. Out of this case came what is now called the Glomar Response, in which the government can simply refuse to confirm or deny the existence of any records in response to a FOIA request. In 1986, the use of the Glomar response was explicitly limited to cases in which revealing the existence of documents would compromise national security, reveal the identity of an informant, or tip off the requester that the government is investigating him. But as ProPublica reported this week, now the government wants to change the FOIA rules so it can say there are no documents pertaining to a request called a no records response, even when there are documents. In other words, the government wants a rule permitting it to lie. The ACLU, along with other groups, has petitioned the government to reconsider this rule change, but according to the ACLU's policy counsel, Mark German, the government's been lying about documents pretty much since the rule governing the Glomar response was tightened 25 years ago.
Despite the fact that the Department of Justice lost this argument in Congress, they apparently began using this false no records response. So what it helps the government do is prevent any kind of judicial oversight because people would be less likely to go into court to try to get records that the government says don't exist.
And so now the Justice Department is, by proposing this rule, trying to bring law enforcement in compliance with a rule that reflects what they're doing anyway.
Basically, they want to ex post facto create a rule that allows them to do what they've already been doing in violation of the rule.
And what are the stakes here for regular people?
The purpose of the Freedom of Information Act request is to give the public access to government information so that public accountability can take place. And one of the key elements of the statute incorporates judicial review in government decisions about exemptions. People have a right to know what exemption is being applied so that they can challenge that in court and a judge can make an independent decision.
Now, we have a little problem here, obviously, since we're speaking to you who opposes this rule as opposed to somebody in the government who would defend it. But do you have access to their arguments?
Basically, what they were arguing was that there was a need to protect ongoing investigations from people who were misusing FOIA, these criminals who are trying to uncover criminal investigations or find informants or, you know, perhaps a hostile nation trying to find out if there is a classified program in existence. If you got an ambiguous answer like a Glomar response and you felt that the documents might actually exist, you'd go into court and try to assert your rights to access those records. But if you got a no records response, you would tend to believe that the government was telling the truth and therefore not challenge them in court.
Does this rule require legislative action?
This is a regulation, so it's the executive branch with public comment, which is why we've been allowed to comment on it, that would go into effect just through administration action. It doesn't need Congress.
Right now, if people are told there are no records, they're probably going to believe it. But if they know that there is a rule that allows the government to lie about it, wouldn't it increase the chances that the requester takes the government to court?
Certainly, what we called institutional requesters like the American Civil Liberties Union, like news media organizations, would certainly, you know, assume that any no records request doesn't necessarily mean no records and would be more likely to bring the case to litigation, which would increase the unnecessary litigation around this.
So the way this is likely to go is this rule gets put into the FOIA book, and then somebody like you challenges it in court.
Part of the way the regulatory process works is that they open it for public comment. We're hopeful that the administration will read our comments, will recognize that it's simply improper for the government to lie to Freedom of Information Act requesters, and particularly because it's not necessary. In other words, they can craft a response that does not confirm whether documents exist, so their goal is met. And that is simply that when they get a request that they think is one of these malicious requests trying to uncover a criminal investigation that's ongoing about that person or uncover an informant, that they simply say that we have interpreted your request as a request for these records, which would be excludable under FOIA if they exist. Therefore, we're not going to process your claim. It's better than a Glomar response because it actually gives definitive information, but it doesn't say whether the records exist. It just says we're not going to look for them.
So what do you think the chances are that your proposed revision carries the day?
I think it's pretty good. It's not just the American Civil Liberties Union. It's Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington and OpenTheGovernment.org that joined us. I hope that the Department of Justice recognizes that it's inappropriate to have a government regulation that affirmatively allows the government to lie to people, particularly that they would be interpreting what is intended to be an open government statute to mislead Americans.
Mm-hmm. It is a little ironic.
Particularly because it's simply not necessary. We don't have to change the regulation. We can follow the intent of Congress, and it's a win-win for everyone. So we're really hopeful that it will win the day.
Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mike German is Policy Counsel on National Security, Immigration, and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union.
When the Internal Revenue Service in Newark, New Jersey, wanted to track down and collect $250,000 from a tax scammer, it asked his internet service provider to turn over the scammer's past 2 years of emails. The government did so under the provisions of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ECPA. But despite ECPA, the service provider refused, telling the IRS to get a warrant. Because while ECPA made sense when it was enacted 25 years ago, widespread storage of old email in the cloud has made all of us vulnerable to routine government snooping. Privacy advocates have long fought to update this law, and now it seems the courts are helping them do the job. Kashmir Hill, who writes the Not So Private Parts blog for Forbes.com, explains the origins of this 1980s legal loophole.
At that time, email was stored locally on your computer, but now most of our email lives in the cloud. We can access it from anywhere, which is wonderful and convenient. Except when the law was created, it was assumed that once that email was sitting up with your provider for more than 180 days, more than 6 months, it was basically abandoned. So it was fine for law enforcement to go in and look at it without a warrant.
What puzzles me is why there was a lower standard for search and seizure of stuff that was deemed to be abandoned. It's still my stuff.
I think the email that had been left with the service provider for more than 6 months was essentially seen as like the trash that you leave on the curb. And like the trash that you leave on the curb, law enforcement was allowed to go through it.
Can you put a number to how many requests the government is making for this kind of stuff?
There's no reporting requirement in ECPA, so law enforcement doesn't have to say how often it goes fishing for this. There is one company that's very transparent about this, Google. And they just released their report for the first half of 2011, and they were received over 6,000 requests for 11,000 different accounts. And that is just the first half of 2011. That's a 30% increase over their numbers from the latter half of 2010.
Now, this question has been litigated. Tell me about the case U.S. versus Warshak.
Well, this is a case involving Stephen Warshak, who I've referred to as a sex pill peddler. He had a herbal supplements company where he was selling something called Enzyte.
Enzyte, that's the Smilin' Bob commercials, and Bob's smiling because he's been enhanced.
This is Bob. Bob is looking cool. And with a call to Enzyte about natural male enhancement, Bob is living large. In a few short weeks, Bob has a big new spring of confidence, a generous swelling of pride, and the one thing every man deserves, a little well-earned respect from the neighborhood.
Many customers said that the supplement didn't work. So Warshak was investigated for deceiving customers, fraud. He eventually was investigated by the IRS, the FBI, the FDA. And because of the loophole, they were able to look at 27,000 emails that had been exchanged by Warshak and his colleagues. He was convicted and given a 25-year prison sentence, But he was shocked that law enforcement was able to just look at tens of thousands of his emails without a warrant. And so he challenged this. It went up the legal system to the Sixth Circuit, which is the highest court below the Supreme Court. And they found that the Stored Communications Act violates the Fourth Amendment, which protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures. The legal scholar Paul Ohm called it a watershed moment in privacy in terms of extending our constitutional rights to the internet.
Now, the government is free to regard this as precedent in only one jurisdiction and go about business as usual elsewhere. Is that what the government's doing?
It doesn't look like it. There's a particular case where a tax collector in Newark was trying to get email from an internet service provider in the Ninth Circuit, which is where California is. And the email provider said, no, we're not going to give you the contents of this person's email, and pointed at the Sixth Circuit decision. The tax collector in Newark objected, but the senior counsel for the IRS told the Newark tax collector, yes, we see this decision out of the Sixth Circuit as being binding nationally. You know, government agencies don't want to build cases by going into people's emails without a warrant, getting evidence that will later be struck down. All I can tell you is that privacy advocates are very reassured by this case out of the Sixth Circuit because it has established precedent that it is unconstitutional to go reading people's emails without a warrant.
All right. Kashmir, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. It was a pleasure.
Kashmir Hill writes the Not So Private Parts blog for Forbes.com.
Coming up, surprising news about network news.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We're devoting the next few interviews to a subject we rarely discuss, TV news, still the way most people get their information. Veteran TV reporter Dave Marish observed in the latest Columbia Journalism Review that, quote, for the first time in history, mankind is developing a universal language, video. People now communicate with video on 2 billion computers and more than 1.5 billion TV sets. And by 2013, you can add another 1 billion video-capable people regularly accessing the web from their cell phones. But while the world increasingly speaks video, says Marish, American TV news is calving its lens, relying less and less on reported pieces from the field called video packages.
What has replaced the video package is the live two-way. Basically, this means that you send a reporter and crew, they find a good location that is both safe and scenic, and then they spend most of their working day attached to it so that at any given hour they can talk with an anchor in New York or Washington or Atlanta, but they don't actually look at the country.
Live now to the town of Erciyes, Al Jazeera's Anita McNaught is there.
Here in Cairo, the government in this area has imposed a curfew.
Well, they've been out here in Occupy San Francisco. They've had a couple eviction notices, so there's been a couple of close calls.
Now, CNN's former chief, Jonathan Klein, told you that, quote, a well-done live report has the advantage of energy and immediacy over a package. Sanjay Gupta, reporting live from the medical center in Haiti, was by far the most powerful story to emerge from the Haiti earthquake last year, and that was a live shot. No tape package, he said, could have captured the drama of this situation as it unfolded.
It was a dramatic moment, and moments are important to stories, but moments are not stories. And when news directors start to confuse great moments with great stories, they get a lot more comfortable with these live moments that can't really pretend, even in a metaphoric way, to tell the whole story.
So what is cable news generally filling up all that time with that used to be filled with video packages?
Talk. When the video package share of CNN dropped by 28%, The chat portion, the conversation and interview portion, went up by 26%. And so what America's news channels have become is not channels of news, but channels of talk about news. And what you get is today's Yammerfests, which have little to do with revealing what's going on.
Okay, you cite sobering statistics for cable news, but the situation isn't nearly as stark for network news.
The situation and the changes at the networks are a little bit different and, yes, less dramatic than at CNN. But again, at the networks, having talked to many experienced overseas correspondents, they will tell you that they are going to the scene of the story less and that they are packaging video whose provenance they cannot exactly vouch for. And this is, you know, especially true of internet video, but it's also true if Reuters is really passing along state television or opposition television.
On the other hand, in places where American journalists can't go, as in much of the coverage of the Arab Spring, that video was absolutely essential, the video that came through the internet, the video that came through Twitter. And I remember listening to tape from the BBC where they said, look, we can't vouch for this, but this is what we have. Keep that in mind when you listen to it. In some places, the only kind of coverage available was coverage from ordinary people who were there on site.
The new world of near universal video is creating a much more transparent universe. It's creating a much more informed universe. But as I say, the one thing you never know is who shot it and what interest did they have in the story, and has that affected the point of view of the video that they're presenting? And the best antidote, and even this is only a partial cure to this simultaneous blessing and curse, is to have reporters who are actually on the scene who can say, videos A, D, and R focused on this, but our sources tell us if they had panned 12 degrees right, they would have seen something they didn't want to show you.
The video reporting from the field, these packages, they take so much time to edit and craft. Do you think we understand the news less well when it is explained, not by a talking head, but by a reporter who knows his or her stuff?
There's a reason why video has captivated so many people around the world. It's incredibly information dense. And when it is married to a well-written narration that underscores for the viewer the logic of the connections between the pieces of video that he is seeing, there's a tremendous amount of real information that can be disposed. All three networks still do video packages, but the number of them and the quality of them is declining, and I don't think you'll find anybody in the major television newsrooms who will try and tell you different.
Dave, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke. It's been a pleasure.
Dave Marish has been a broadcast journalist for half a century. For years, network news has steadily lost viewers, but rumors of its death appear to be greatly exaggerated. New Nielsen ratings show a sudden spike in viewership, the first in a decade. News Lab's executive director Deborah Potter says several factors may be contributing to the uptake, not least of which was the newsiness of the past year.
Japanese earthquake, tornadoes, the Arab Spring, the killing of Osama bin Laden, not to mention the kind of news that affects people daily, and that is the continuing economic struggles of Americans. So there are sort of good news-driven reasons for people to be watching more news. The other possibility is that people are spending less doing other things. You know, we used to say one of the problems the evening news faced was the time of day it was on, that a lot of people were not yet home from work, or perhaps they were out to dinner. But when you've got an economy in the trench like this, a lot of people don't have jobs, so they're already home.
The unemployed are pushing up the ratings.
It could be. It could be a part of it.
It didn't gain just a little. The three evening newscasts added almost 2 million viewers combined in the second quarter compared to the same period last year.
Yes, and that's about a 10% increase. So that's a major jump. That's quite noticeable when you look at the declining trend from previous years. And the network morning show saw a similar uptick. They added a little over 1 million viewers, about 10%. So, you know, it's too soon, I think, to call it a trend, but I do think it's worth paying attention to, and I guarantee you the people at the network news divisions are doing just that.
Who are these people who are tuning in?
For the evening newscast, the average viewer is over 60. But all three of the network newscasts this year added viewers in an age group that advertisers love, 25 to 54, the people who typically were told just don't watch network news.
What do you think accounts for this?
The fact that we had some turnover at the network news level this year, that is always an occasion for sampling. People will watch a new anchor, and they did. The other thing we've seen is some changes in the approach of the three newscasts. You know, it used to be said that you could turn on any nightly newscast on any given night and see the same news stories in the same order. That's not true anymore. In fact, I think the three newscasts are taking on distinct personalities, which means they're giving viewers a choice, which viewers didn't feel they had in recent years. The flavor, the tenor of the cable news channels also has changed, and that may be one additional factor for the return of viewers to the network evening newscasts. It's one thing to turn on the news during the day and find out what's going on. It's another to turn on the news during the day and find out that Steve Jobs is still dead 2 days later. You know, the sort of concentration on of the flogging of one story, I would argue, diminish the value of those cable outlets as real sort of news updaters.
So cable news ceases to provide the kind of news competition it used to offer?
If, in fact, you thought you were going to tune in and get an update on the news on one of the cable channels, you would either get today overhyping of one or two stories for hours on end, or a lot of political points of view, certainly at that evening hour when the networks are on. What perhaps has happened is that the viewer had all these other sources. They went out and sampled them for a long, long time, and then found themselves drifting back to a place where they could get what's always been there, you know, a nice nightly update of what's happened and what's important in the world.
So then the natural question follows, will they be heading back to the newspapers? Maybe not paper newspapers, but ones online, perhaps.
Clearly, there's a strong belief that news and information remains a commodity that people care about. People have written off the network newscast for years, dead, buried, dusty, ancient audience, all of that. And the fact is their audience is and remains huge compared to the cable channels. Four times as many people will watch the nightly news on the three broadcast channels as watch the three all-news channels in all of prime time. So I often say that the network newscasts remind me of that guy in Monty Python in the Holy Grail, you know, at the end where they're going around collecting up the plague victims. Bring out your dead. They grab one fellow who says, I'm not dead yet. I don't think they're dead either.
Deborah, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Deborah Potter is the founder and executive director of NewsLab. Andrew Tyndall runs the Tyndall Report, which monitors the nightly newscasts of ABC, NBC, and CBS. He agrees with Potter that their audiences may be attracted to the new variety in their newscasts.
You can no longer tune into any one of the three broadcasts and get the same news. You're actually getting a different take on the news from one network to the other. I haven't seen this much variation for 15 years.
Okay, so let's talk about Diane Sawyer's nightly newscasts first. What sets them apart?
The traditional role of the half-hour nightly newscast was to give a summary of the major events of the previous 24 hours. ABC has now stepped away from that role. So what you have is ABC, with Diane Sawyer as its anchor, copying a lot of the techniques that she learned when she was on the morning shows. So what you've got is you've got an evening version of Good Morning America.
This is World News. Tonight, Daily Dose. Could some of the vitamin supplements we take increase the risk of death from disease?
A small secret of happiness. Sometimes it turns out you don't need to spend money or go on vacation to achieve it. And here's
it. It was a day of emotion and drama in the trial of the doctor charged in Michael Jackson's death. One by one.
The word world is in the ABC title. ABC World News. It's about the only place you see coverage of the world is in the title. and they'd certainly prefer to cover things like, you know, the trial of Michael Jackson's doctor versus the plight of Muammar Gaddafi.
Most of the Sawyer coverage seems to fall into the news you can use directly category, as in health, diet, family, personal stories. What about the economy?
Even the coverage of the economy uses this news you can use motif. So, for instance, they have a huge feature called Made in America. And the point of that is to get you to change your behavior as a consumer to buy more goods that are made in America. And that's the method by which the unemployment crisis will be solved.
And pivoting to CBS, we went from Katie Couric to Scott Pelley, and that meant a world of difference?
It's interesting. When Katie Couric was there, a lot of the fingers were pointed at her because her newscast was too soft. Or suspicion that it was too soft because she came from the morning programs. Scott Pelley is not doing more news replacing Katie Couric. In other words, news, things that happened in the last 24 hours. But he's certainly doing more serious content. And that's the reason why I see the imprint of 60 Minutes in his newscast.
Tonight, a lifeline for homeowners. The president announces new rules to make it easier to refinance.
At a summit meeting late today, European leaders announced they had agreed on a plan to shore up banks.
And all around the country, listen to this, there are 4.6 unemployed workers competing for every job that's available.
The big increase that we've seen in the last 4 months since Pelley took over is in their serious coverage of the economy. And now the economy is not actually a newsy topic. It's not one where there are a lot of developing stories, but there are major overarching trends. The housing crisis, the jobs crisis, and the increase in poverty and homelessness. They're all trends that Pelley has put an emphasis on compared to what went before him and compared to the other two newscasts as well.
The other two newscasts. So let's talk about NBC. It's been number one for a while. Does that mean it steers a middle course, or is it altogether different in its tone and story choices?
It's made the fewest changes over the last years, but because of the changes that the other two have made, it now stands alone as being a differentiated product in itself. What's happened is that it's now the most old-fashioned and conventional in adopting the role of delivering the breaking news stories of the last 24 hours.
On the broadcast tonight, Gaddafi is dead. The dictator who ruled for 42 years is gone, and a new era now begins for Libya. Coming to America, a massive island of trash and debris from the earthquake in Japan drifting across the Pacific. Now we have to turn overseas to the unfolding disaster in eastern Turkey after a powerful 7.2 earthquake.
Its news emphasis is highly concentrated on natural disasters and weather. Now, NBC News owns the Weather Channel. So this is one way in which they maintain the claim on breaking sudden, immediate news is by emphasizing the importance of meteorology and also earthquakes and bad stuff like that.
So fewer long-form investigative pieces than CBS.
And fewer human interest pieces than ABC.
More in the style of, and that's the way it is?
To me, this is an antiquated way of doing a newscast. Since we were last on air, these are the things that happened. That comes from newspapers. It's a 150-year-old idea. There are very few natural events that actually happen in the real world that conform to a 24-hour cycle. The reason why that cycle was considered to be important was because of the convenience of the printing press, not because it was an accurate way of representing the world.
It bears repeating that television is still most people's number one source of news and information, and that the combined network viewership completely swamps any kind of viewership on cable.
The reason why throughout the last 40 years, television has been the dominant medium for people to get their news is because people would sit down and watch anything on television, including news. There's a lot of news that isn't very good to do on television. There's a lot of news that would be better to be done interactively or even, you know, on radio, for instance.
Heaven forfend.
But there is some types of news that are really good on video. There's no reason to suppose that the broadcast networks aren't going to continue to be a leader in covering that type of news.
So obviously there are some stories that are so big that they still lead all three networks, right?
Obviously. Just take last week. The huge story of Gaddafi getting killed led all three networks. The big story of President Obama taking all the troops out of Iraq led all three network newscasts the same night. The trivial story of the Tigers getting loose in Ohio led all three networks.
Well, I'm glad our priorities are still clear.
Gaddafi, Iraq, Tigers.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Andrew Tyndall monitors nightly network newscasts for the Tyndall Report. And now, for your listening pleasure, the theme from NBC's Huntley Brinkley Report, which your parents used to watch.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Gianna Palmer and Doug Anderson, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.